I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is Dr. Christopher Perrin, and you're listening to Café Scholé. Welcome to another podcast episode in which we seek to bring restful, contemplative learning back to our schools, homeschools, and lives. That is to say, to bring Scholé back to school. I'm here with two of my friends, Jolie Hodge and Jesse Hake. In this particular podcast, we want to explore the ways in which Scholé can be a reality in one's life, even when you're not seeking it. In other words, we've all bumped into undistracted time where we study something that is worthwhile, that transforms and refreshes us. Even as children, there have been times when we have encountered this very human activity that so many thought was the highest human activity, Scholé. And if you've been following this podcast, you know that Scholé, ironically, is a Greek word that is the root word for our English word school. And there isn't often a lot of Scholé in our schools. Undistracted time, contemplative and restful learning. Not that there shouldn't be any active learning. Of course, we need to learn skills, learn how to conduct experiments, do algebraic equations, translate Latin, memorize vocabulary. There's so many things that we do that are very active when it comes to education. But the trouble is, often in education and schooling, it's almost completely active learning with no restful learning. In other words, there's not often a Sunday in our learning experience. There's not a Sabbath. So what if just 1/7 of what we did in our schooling and teaching involved restful learning? Okay, so here we are. I'm going to ask each of my guests to just give a brief biography of how they came to be an educator and a professional working in the educational world. And then I'm going to ask each of them to share maybe even a childhood experience or an experience when you were a student, when you encountered restful learning that was refreshing. So with me is Jolie Hodge, as I mentioned, and Jesse Hake. I'll go to you first, Jolie. Tell us how you ended up becoming a teacher in brief, and then if you could segue to a time when you enjoyed restful learning.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me to talk with you and your guests. You have a lot to do with my story about how I came to classical education. You were the headmaster at a local bricks and mortar school, if you recall. I often joke that it was at the turn of the century back in 1999. So I've been teaching since the last century. But I was looking for an opportunity to get into education, and none of the education courses at the college where I was going to seemed to really embody the kind of education that I wanted to really pursue. I was a history and political science major, and when you and I had talked about the school and about the classical school there, you emphasized that the education courses and certifications weren't what we were looking for. We were looking for passionate, lifelong educators who could appreciate the Western tradition and be encouraged and teachable to go back and recover this lost way of learning. And that was what really spoke to me. And so I've been a classical educator since then and had many opportunities to grow. One of the first areas was the fact that the seventh grade class needed a logic teacher. And that, you know, logic being one of the core disciplines in the classical tradition where all of the other traditions kind of intersect with it, or the other disciplines intersect with it, it gave me an opportunity to see just how broad and deep the pedagogy can be, the classical pedagogy can be, and all of the ways to kind of enjoy classical education through these different paradigms of grammar and logic and rhetoric. So that's been a lot of fun to kind of continue to pursue that over the many years. An experience with Scholé myself. So I grew up in Saudi Arabia in the early 80s, And I was going to an international school there and learning all the same subjects that everybody else was learning, math and science and history and literature and all. But I had one unique, probably leg up on most students, and that was that every year we had an opportunity to take a trip somewhere, to come back home to the United States. And on our way home, my parents would plan different stops for us so that it wasn't just a direct flight from Saudi Arabia back to Pennsylvania, but we would stop and visit different parts of the world. And in many cases, they tried to coincide something that we were learning about in history with some stops that we would make on the way home. And so the year that I was studying, for example, ancient history, we had the opportunity to stop in Egypt. We went to Cairo, and we stopped in Greece, and we went to Athens, and, you know, we stopped in England, and I got to go and explore some of the English countryside as well. And so I wouldn't have been able to name it as Scholae, but I had the content knowledge that was attributed to me through the school, through the active learning education that you had described. But then I had this opportunity to go and see and taste and touch and experience and smell and listen to tour guides who were telling the stories afresh and allowing me to make some of that connection. There were no tests, there were no quizzes, lots of opportunities to think deeply, to kind of assimilate and put it all together, have some delightful conversation around a good meal, experiencing the flavors of the country we're in, the culture and the customs. That certainly is sort of an extreme case of Scholae. But it created that heightened dimensioned learning that can only be found when the books are closed to a certain degree. And you're bringing with you your experiences to this new place and sort of enjoying deeply and in a very robust experiential sense.
You're reminding me that a lot of homeschooling families like to take tours and trips whenever they can for this purpose.
That's right.
And that apparently that can still be a part of one's education.
Yeah.
Can you remember a time on one of these trips when you were kind of mesmerized or just held in a kind of spell while you were viewing something, gazing at something, or conversing about something?
So when you stand at the foot of one of the Great Pyramids and the size of those rocks is, you know, right in front of you, and then you realize how many of them there are. And pictures, I mean, pictures are wonderful and an experience, but when you're standing there, especially as a child, and looking at them and seeing that they're 2.5-3-person-high boulders, and then, you know, my dad was an engineer. My mom was an English major. And so she always tried to get us to experience things through the story of it, right? So we would talk through the story and the narrative of what we were seeing, experience. My father would also ask questions, you know, how do you think they got that top stone up there? You know, there's no mountainside here. They don't have cranes. You know, how did this happen? And, you know, even just standing and having those kinds of questions, but that was probably it's one of the seven wonders of the world for a reason, you know, and its majesty in its size and scope. But then we also had an opportunity to go inside the pyramids, which was also interesting. So to see them beyond just their external, and to go in and how tight and narrow the passages were. And there's a lingering odor that is in the passages and so forth. It's musty. It's dark. There is no sunlight. You know, these were you know, tombs. Obviously,
you're breathing in dust from maybe five millennia ago.
Yeah. Right. And all the germs. No, I wasn't too worried about that at the time. But yeah, I mean, so the whole experience of it was captivating, and I can still see probably imperfectly, given that it was through the eyes of a child in the decades that have since passed. But that experience married with what I knew allowed me to really kind of explode with questions and the curiosity and looking for, you know, I was definitely in awe, you know, and then we could discover something new together. But, you know, it was such an extension beyond what I could have experienced in a book.
It sounds like, I love the fact that you use the word wonder. Of course, the pyramids are one of the seven wonders of the world. But there's an element of wonder, is there not, to this idea of Scholae, something that takes you kind of outside of yourself. When you're at wonder, you kind of forget yourself, mm-hmm. and you're absorbed into this thing that you want to possess and know. And as you are also pointing out, it seems that it led you to become eager for more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You said you used the word curious.
Yeah.
Did you go read some more about Egypt as a result?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's two things. One, I had my parents did not have all the answers, nor did the guides, but they were guides in that sense of like the classical idea of a teacher, that they could at least point to things and raise questions. My father didn't have an answer for how the top rock got to the top, but either necessarily.
Which could be helpful, not to always provide the bad answer, even if you have it.
Right.
So that the student is living with that wonder and curiosity for a while.
Absolutely, and there's something really. I think especial about giving children the opportunity to, because they don't have the same inhibitions that an adult has to have to find and rest on the answer. And I do just remember there was a freedom that was there, not just because there weren't tests and assessments, but because I had no inhibitions about the fact that I was there to fully engage and to learn and to really just enjoy and delight in it without any... anything else that might have cluttered that experience in some way. And I think that probably, and I haven't talked to my parents about this, but I could ask them if experiencing it with us as children in that kind of very innocent delightfulness that comes along with being a child, if that allowed them to appreciate it in ways that maybe they didn't expect. I would imagine that the benefit really goes both ways to doing this with your children at a very young age and, experiencing it. And I've seen that with my daughter. While taking her to places and seeing what captures her curiosity and things that I wouldn't have necessarily thought to be that we could have lingered and talked about, but boy, she saw something that I didn't and she tried to reason through it in her own way and led to a delightful experience as well.
Boy, you've opened up so many different interesting aspects of Scholae, this idea of gazing, contemplation, wonder, curiosity, the childlike way that students often come to things with this just openness to see and understand. You're listening to the Scholae Cafe podcast, and we're exploring Scholae, and I'm here with Jolie Hodge and Jesse Hake, and Jolie didn't mention this. I should mention this, that Jolie works with me here at Classical Academic Press. She's our Vice President of Marketing and Sales and Operations. She's been leading our online Scholae Academy, so we have an online academy named after this idea of Scholae, trying to bring restful learning even to an online format. And so Jolie's been a teacher for many years. She wrote a couple of logic books. Thank you for what you shared. And I'm going to move to Jesse now. Jesse is also a colleague here at the press, and he is also a vice president. He's the vice president of our product development. He leads our editorial side, and he directs Classical U, our online teacher training platform. And I know that Jesse grew up... I know a little bit about both their stories. I'm really glad to hear about the pyramids of Egypt from Jolie, because I hadn't heard that story before. But I know a number of stories from Jesse's life. He grew up in Taiwan, spent, I think, 14 years, am I right, in Taiwan?
Yes, that's right.
And he had a number of adventuresome experiences in Taiwan. But could you filter, as you think about your own childhood, Jesse, give us a time when you were transfixed by something that caused you to be curious and wonder and study.
Yeah, hearing Jolie's stories, it struck me that there's an intentionality that is behind a lot of these experiences of wonder. There's a connection to schedule and the intentionality of your parents in making this extra space between places, as they're traveling when families are often under a lot of duress. To say we're going to stop somewhere and do an extra thing and carve that out. I was also blessed with parents who were both really educators. I was homeschooled from grades 4 up through my graduation as a senior in high school and also raised overseas, as Chris has mentioned. And because of being homeschooled, the flexibility that brought just gave all kinds of opportunities for Scholae. I would really go to the family life routines, though, as kind of a starting place with reading out loud was a tremendous priority and something that we all just absolutely love to do. And the amount of time we invested reading out loud as a family was really extraordinary as I look back on it. And just gathered around listening to a story be read out loud and very understated ways, or, you know, noticing the delight that everyone else was taking in something that was delighting you was just such a remarkable experience. Mm. I remember one story. My dad is now, he's a Presbyterian minister, but migrated from being a missionary into teaching literature at the college level over the course of his life, and is a literature professor at Patrick Henry. But we were reading not a particularly sophisticated book as a family. In one case, I don't remember what the book was, but it was not high literature. But some of the characters were really in a very desperate situation, and my dad, at mealtime, shortly after, was praying for them without realizing what he was doing. And that was just a funny illustration of the way that the whole family gets wrapped, you know, in a story and the experience that is together.
Let's pray for Frodo and Sam that they might be able to make it through Mordor.
It's exactly that type of thing that was going on. And we were all, you know, snickering under our breath as our dad was praying. And then he realized, as he heard us laughing, what he had been doing. He's also a bit of the quintessential absent-minded professor, as you can probably tell from that story, in certain respects. But one other example of school I'll mention is from my own childhood, is within the context of a family vacation. We were with another family, and they wanted to go to some amusement park rides at a water park in the area. But we had committed already before the beginning of this day to stay on the beach together and to sort a huge pile of sand on a big white sheet into all the different colors and textures that we could find within each of the sand grains. And so we spent an entire day as a family sorting a pile of sand by color and texture. And the careful attention to one grain of sand at a time. And then the arguments and debates over, you know, how many categories of color and texture should we have? So we created, you know, maybe in the end, 15 or so piles by color and texture that we were sorting into. And there were some debates over individual grains of sand. But that collective kind of attention, by the end of that day, we had a sense that we were sitting on a beach that was truly astounding. You know, the kinds of things that went into the sand, lava rocks, bits of coral, bits of shell, other types of stone. It just led to all this conversation, but it was really an almost ridiculous investment of time, you know, as a family. But it left an impression on all of us, with regard to each other, with regard to where we were. God's world. Mm. So that kind of intentionality, there's a kind of extravagance in that. Mm-hmm.
Could you, both of you, address this intentionality, or as you put it, in other words, you use attention, the collective attention. It seems that a part of Skolé is this ability to focus and to attend to something with this, you know, kind of intentionality that is different. More intense than our kind of everyday experience.
As Jesse was sharing that last story, I've never spent that much time categorizing sand. Oh, that sounds fascinating. When we lived in, after we came back from Saudi, we lived in Virginia, and back behind our house, as part of our property, there was a creek that ran through. And my parents did not schedule us for everything that could have possibly scheduled, the way that kids are very often overscheduled today. And so when it was time to go outside and play with or without a friend, I was supposed to go outside and find something to do. And I wandered down to that creek all the time, and there was a hollowed out tree that had been hollowed out by lightning ages before. And that turned into my sort of imaginary palace of some kind. And I gathered and collected things and went in and organized things in particular categories of whatever made sense to me as a child. And, you know, they had different places inside this huge hollowed out trunk of this tree that I would go in and play in. And it was my sort of space and time to explore and, you know, to make decisions about things and to, you know, try to make sense of what it was down there, whether it was, you know, rocks or, you know, skeletal remains of something or another or, you know, whatever it might be. But I had time is really the point. And it was unscheduled time and it was that undistracted time. Nobody, you know, not until I heard my mom calling for me for either lunch or dinner did I have to come back. And even then I had to kind of peel myself away from what I was doing.
Could you describe, either of you, that sense of timelessness that sometimes is a part of this experiencing Skole? Like, how many hours did you spend doing that, and how did you experience the passage of time or its lack of it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure I didn't have an awareness of it. I don't even remember being aware of the time, you know, going by. Mm-hmm. It was just long summer days and, you know, just having just fun in my own little world. So, you know, it really was as if the confines of, you know, the calendar and our man-made time slots didn't really apply in some ways. But I think not that particular activity had long-term bearing. I didn't become a naturalist or anything like that. But it fostered that that sense of me that was a good and that what I was doing was valuable and that undistracted time is something not to be shunned or to scheduled into. You know, I think longingly of that. So it imprinted on me and sort of shaped and formed how I think about how I would like to spend time now. I want my daughter to have.
I'm reminded in a lot of different Christian traditions, some of the very old prayers in the liturgy, there's a phrase that you'll come across that is, set aside all earthly cares. So we're praying together that we would go into this kind of timeless communion with God, who is outside of time and invites us in a way that we can't really wrap our minds around into communion with him and therefore into. And I think that happens, you know, in prayer, but in all of life because of who we are as God's image bearers and his children. So that, and in childhood, I think we can go into those spaces in play. I don't know if it's Chesterton who says something about how offended children are sometimes when an adult says something, interjects it into their playtime. And you know, sometimes the children will try to weave it into the narrative and make it disappear by becoming a part of their world. But if the adult's insisting on it for whatever reason, it's quite jarring, you know, to be brought out of that. But even as adults, this isn't something we should lose. And I think we all could easily imagine, you know, times and places at different parts of our lives where we do become engrossed in something, in a sense, time. We escape time.
Yes, I think we've all experienced that, and I'm glad you brought up the church tradition because, you know, the Eucharist is a time where you should lay aside earthly cares and commune with Christ and the church. And that seems to me to be an appropriate call. I mean, even the idea of Sunday worship, this setting aside this day, stopping work. So the Sabbath principle is there, and the communion principle is there. And so Skole seems to be related to that as this human longing to be united with something true, good, and beautiful, or the divine, in a way that is timeless, maybe because, as you point out, because it's divine and God himself is timeless. Well, this is really interesting. And for those of you listening, you know, we're beginning to explore the application of the idea of Skole. And so we're talking to Jesse Haake and Jolie Hodge about how they've experienced it as children, really. And you've used experiences first, which I just note is interesting. The pyramids of Giza, collecting sand and sorting sand at a beach. So the natural world is one place where we enjoy Skole. But as we close, could you guys give an example maybe of this happening in a conversation? with another person, or in the reading of a book, or the hearing of a presentation, could be a lecture or a sermon, poetry reading. Can you think of some other instances where you've had a similar scholae experience in those kind of categories?
Well, there's an ideal in prayer life where you would be praying without ceasing, right? Mm-hmm. Paul brings it up. And I do think there's a sense in which when you settle into any activity, there's a potential union between the active and the contemplative, where if you're really able to be absorbed in the activity, you enter into a kind of contemplation of your own activity, a contemplation of the thing with which you're engaging. So if you're reading, singing, there's that kind of a space. And, of course, those are the most delightful ways to work, to read a book and to really just be in that book, to be even working with someone stacking firewood and to almost be lost in the rhythm of the work with the other person.
Well, I know because you're both readers and teachers. And by the way, I didn't mention that Jesse as well has been a classical educator for some time and an administrator too. I know that you have read books that have taken you away, that have enabled you to escape time. Mm-hmm. Can you share an experience of something that you've read that did that for you?
As you ask these questions, my brain just can't quite figure out which one to talk about.
That's a good sign.
It is. It just I don't know if I can pick. You know, I've experienced this. You know, there have been Lewis books, for example. The Great Divorce is one that we're actually all reading as a company right now over the next several months. But it's one that in my early adult life I picked up and I decided I was going to read it every year. And that book, just because it requires that you both go into it and then come out of it and back into it and come back out of it, and that processing of it just to be in the story. But then you have to, if you're really going to appreciate the story, then you have to come out of it and experience it as the reader looking into it with some examination of yourself. I think books that require that in and out transcendence of the narrative are places where I've found that the most. And if I think about it, the experiences that I've had have also been that same rhythm of both going into the experience but then coming out of it and, you know, looking at it again in a different way. And that for me is the scholae of an exercise. If it's ever just one or the other, it either becomes a task or it becomes just sort of a mental exercise. But the scholae is sort of, for me, the marrying of the two at the soul level, where you find that joy and delight in your inner self. And it's that marriage of the outward expression and the sort of ethereal expression of it together in some ways. And so books that sort of require that of you, like The Great Divorce in this case, is one place I've experienced that.
You're calling to mind a book that my wife and I are reading, George MacDonald's Lilith, and the raven in Lilith says at one point to Mr. Vane that about regarding books, that the books are a door in and a door out. And you know, a good book, a good conversation is kind of a doorway into something. Jesse used the word intentionality, like we're going for something, but in the process of going and reaching for something, we end up leaving ourselves and going to some other place. And that somehow describes scholae, is one aspect of scholae. I'm so glad that you brought that up. And maybe just to conclude, the word attention is from that Latin attenere, which means to reach for, you know, to be reach. Even the word tension, you know, has this idea of something being pulled because you're reaching. There's something about scholae that is intentional and attentional, but in the process, it's relieving and refreshing rather than creating tension. Rather than it's escape. It's that everything that the two of you, but it was wonder, it's curiosity. So I hope those of you listening are are enjoying this kind of our own kind of traveling in to Skole, maybe to go someplace else. We'll continue this conversation in our next podcast with Jolie and Jesse to explore more ways that Skole can be made practical for you as you're thinking about it. What we'll do on our next podcast is we'll ask these two to describe ways they've been able to bring the experience of Skole to their own students, because they've been classical educators for quite some time. So they'll be thinking about some good examples of how that has happened. So thank you very much, Jesse and Jolie, for joining us today. And we'll look forward to being with you again at our next podcast. And thank you to those of you who have been listening to Skole Cafe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.